city life. You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. My guest for episode 215 is Lynn Drury, a New Orleans singer-songwriter who's released 10 albums since 2001. We'll discuss the title track to her new album, High Tide, then 11-11 from 2017's Rise of the Fall, and Drugstore from her first album, 2001's Crossing Frequencies. We'll conclude by listening to I Waited Too Long, also from that new album. Right now you're hearing City Life from Sugar on the Floor, 2011. Hear more at lynndrury.com, that's two N's. Hear more of this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or support the effort at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will play a little bit of City Life from Sugar on the Floor, 2011. You were saying that is your most requested, most popular song you close with. What is your career arc? Like, has it just been steadily going up, or was that sort of the peak?
Yes, a steady, slow incline. Yes, just a steady, slow. I don't know. City Life, it's one of those songs that I remember writing, and I remember it just sort of being a stream of consciousness. And I mean, I repeat every single line twice. It's just the funniest thing to me. But for some reason, it was a post-Katrina song. It's so funny because I can't get away without playing it. I have to play it. So it's a lovely song. I think, you know, I was just riding my bike and noticing the broken windows and they were shimmering and seeing the beauty and destruction, I guess.
Yes. I know New Orleans more than some other places. I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. Okay, we're local artists, we're Madison artists, but there's not a particular image that connotes. When I lived in Austin, there was this just rampant Texas chauvinism that, you know, unless you're from Texas, I don't even know if we'll grudgingly let you in the bars. But New Orleans, I haven't been sure if it's quite as strong. Certainly New Orleans artists that I've talked to, New Orleans ends up being a theme, and especially because you have things like the hurricane, you know, that are so distinctively, that seems to go in how even you describe your sound, that it's what New Orleans.
Yeah, Nola Americana sort of adapted that. And just because New Orleans gets in your blood, it gets in your rhythm and permeates everything, just like the heat. And yeah, I feel like there's a bit of New Orleans in my sound just because being here. I don't think it's possible to be here and not have some of the New Orleans beat and the rhythm get into your music.
There's horns creeping in some of these things. So do you mostly play as a solo artist? And so then when you get in the studio and have a full band, that it's sort of like the Nashville thing that is, you know, the producer's band, it seems like in this case, or no?
It depends. I do all the festivals with the band and I have a set band right now. Of course, being in New Orleans, a lot of these guys are in 3 other bands, you know, so there's that element. I do play most of my weekly stuff here. I play solo, but yeah, like I have a band and it's constantly changing and it's constantly being, somebody can't be there. So you're always working and rehearsing to get the new person worked in, kind of thing. But for the time being, for the past few years, I've been working with John Fole on lead guitar. But I didn't record this with him because I recorded with Papa Molly. But my goal for this next year is to get in with John as well. And the band that I'm working with right now, which is Eric Bolivar, doing the live thing for me. And he plays in a bunch of different bands. And
he's the bass player or he's the...
He's the drummer.
The drummer, okay.
Eric Bolivar is... That's who I play with live. Eric Bolivar, John Fole, and Renee Komen. Renee actually went in the studio with me and he's my bassist. And he plays with the Iguanas and other people. And I'm blanking. Eric plays with a million bands and stuff.
Let's use this to introduce the first song, which is the title track from High Tide, the new album, which, as you said, Papa Molly, Malcolm Wellborn, is producing, playing all the guitars except for the acoustics. So if there's multiple, like the steel and stuff, is that also him? Or
actually, on High Tide, Roddy Romero plays the slide. And Roddy Romero plays a little bit of accordion. You can barely hear it, but he also plays a little piano part for me. He was kind of in the studio with us that day. All of the electric guitars and electric mandolins and the Omni chords are Papa Molly.
Okay, so this song, had you been playing it with the live band or pretty much this is, you're bringing your compositions to this record, you're going to give Papa Molly sort of first tack at the arrangement and then you're going to adapt it to the live band. Is that your normal?
Actually, this song is an anomaly from the whole record, and it's really kind of quite interesting because we went in for other songs to record. I didn't have this song at all written. This song came to me. We were, you know, staying out on the Vermilion River at the Dockside Studios. It's a very beautiful rows of old oaks that you walk to the studio from the pool house. It's just a gorgeous setting. And we had recorded all day the first day. We were there 3 nights. I recorded the first day. And then immediately when I went back to the pool house, we were making dinner and stuff, this melody just came to me. It's the first time ever that I've been able to write a whole song in one day. Well, not the first time I'd written a song in one day, but to be able to record it the next day. So I wrote it out. I stayed up late because I had finished the song, but I didn't have a chorus. And so it was just like this dream that came to me, and the river and the water and all that stuff. So On the Water just kind of came to me, that little phrase, and I had the melody with it. It just all came about in like 5 or 6 hours. So the next day we went in. It's the first time I've ever like worked out an arrangement with the band on the spot like that. And then just went in and recorded it. And it came, I just think it came out so, so great. So I ended up naming the record after that song.
probably out there on the water.
You bring this in, you've got the three other musicians playing with you, or is it four at this point, just in the initial, like, are you recording the whole thing live, or is it you recording yourself, and then they start?
This record, I think it's special because it was mostly live. I mean, you know, obviously, recut some overdubs and stuff like that, but for the most part, we did three takes, and one of them was it, and this one's no different. It's pretty much arranged right there with everybody. It's Doug Belote on drums, a great session drummer. He's kind of like, he was in Nashville for a while. He goes up to Nashville and he's a great session drummer. And that's pretty much all he does. He doesn't really play a lot of live shows. He loves the studio. So it's Doug Belote on drums, Renee Komen, and Papa Molly. That's who the core band. I think when we went back for overdubs a few months later is when we added the extra instrumentation on.
So all these vocal subtleties, you try to hold it all, are just in the three takes that you did. Are they all quite different? Because you're still feeling this out, right? This is not something you've gotten to season.
No, I mean, it was pretty much hammered out and then tried. But the one thing about this song is because of the bass and the drum rhythm, I can't really play it and sing it the way I had to overdub the guitar to fit in the rhythm. So it's a specific rhythm that I'm not accustomed to playing. And so in order to fit in the groove, I play differently solo. I'll just say that. But it came out really special with the recording. But yeah, I had to overdub the acoustic on that one. And that's the only one that I had to overdub to get the rhythm. And then I realized I can't sing and do that rhythm at the same time. I mean, I can kind of fake it, you know, but one of those magical recording things.
Yeah, I really like that rolling drum part. So it sounds like you brought in the song, this suggested to the drummer to do this, but then you couldn't actually do the thing that you were, that he was supposed to be reacting to, that you had to, okay, well, let me just put my guitar down and I'll sing with you. And
it's an intricacy because I'm very much usually driving the band with my rhythm. And they came up with, bass and drums came up with an alternate kind of Van Morrison-y thing. And it's because I'm super particular. So I could play it straight kind of. It's like, no, this is clashing a little bit here and there. So it's a very particular rhythm that I had to nail. And I'll have to practice it before we play it live.
Well, that's always but, fun. I mean, as a hummer strummer, as a jazz person derogatorily said to me at some point, about folk and rock-based musicians, people who strum on the guitar, you have your patterns. Like, this is how, by default, my hand is going to, the rhythms I'm going to do. And so if you're going to get out of that, either you have to consciously, okay, I'm going to try a different time signature, a different technique, a different way of playing, or have somebody else actually introduce it. Just, okay, I know this sounds like five other things I've done. Please make a different rhythm.
Right, exactly. They call me the bar chord queen over here in New Orleans. And I got my little strum thing. I do an up strum and I'm very rhythmic and my timing is great, but it's like this little particular, almost like it's like a funk up thing. Like, yeah, but the band did a great job on that song for sure.
And I guess it's nice having the lead guitarist being the producer because he's playing a lot like throughout, but yet it doesn't cloud out your vocal. It's not just like, I got a guitar here in the band and I don't know what to do with them. I don't know. Have you run into that at any point that because you do write these often very open rhythms, like, oh, just jam over this, that I would think it might be easy for guitarists to get carried away and you kind of have to back them off.
That happens all the time. That's why Papa Molly's, he knows where to put the guitar. It's a lead singer's nightmare, right? I've seen artists bigger than me, even like, I'm like, yeah, he's playing all over her vocal. And she's just looking at him like, what are you doing? So I've had to fight, you know, you have to fight for it because it's taken me many years to sort of ask for what I want, but I'm finally doing it. So now if I have somebody, you know, and I've had producers, you know, tell me that over the years too. It's just like, you know, lay off the vocal, just lay off of it. Try to intertwine with it. Try to find the melody and try to comp the melody for the singer, right? And find a way to intertwine that in as soon as the vocal is over. I also, John Fole told me something on tour last summer that was interesting. He's like, you know, you do leave space for that. Not a lot of singers. Have you heard a lot of the pop stuff, you know, that's coming out? And I'm like, of course, I do listen to pop music and pop country and stuff, but the singer's not leaving any space for anything else. And I was like, really? He goes, you leave so much space. That's kind of nice. So that's a nice compliment, but it's definitely a dance. And it's definitely, if one person isn't listening to everything else, it's a sad state. If people are listening, even if there's something that goes wrong or whatever, it's like, it's a beautiful, beautiful dance to play music live with people, everybody listening to their little spaces, you know, because everybody, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, they're all sitting in a space.
Sure. And do you have ideas often where, okay, I hear a counter melody that responds to me, yada, da, 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 da. Or is that just the call of like, well, let's arrange that for a horn. Don't make somebody actually in your band do that. I mean, it seemed like in this, are you pretty hands-off and letting like that intro riff that he comes in right at the beginning that at least betrays awareness of what the melody is going to eventually be? Like clearly he didn't do that first take. That this was something that he worked out. Are you just relying on them and their excellent musicality to come up with the counter melodies, even though you're the one getting the writing credit, but they're going to provide extra melodic content?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's great at that. So the melody was there, right? So I came in with the whole song. I came in with the whole song pretty much laid out. I think the only thing that maybe was arranged, the drummer helped arrange, but as far as like the little solo section, like I think that was a group, you know, okay, let's just stay on the one for the little solo section. So because I only had half a verse for the third part, you know, so working things out like that, I love the process of it. And Papa Molly just has a sense of simplicity. That solo thing that he does in the beginning, I can play it. And it's just so simple, but it's so great. And it's perfectly, but no, I'm not telling him what notes to play ever. He's inferring that from the melody and from the vibe and from the rhythm. And I hope we can produce together again. You know, he and I work really well together.
Now, I don't want to press you to explain particular lyric lines to me, especially if that's, you know, something that you feel like would ruin the majesty of the song, the mystery, the letting people introduce it themselves. But I'm wondering, given the quickness with which you wrote this, how clear is the narrative? Because it starts out as if you're talking about my dead friend or something, you know, that went off the deep. But then it's, you're addressing somebody, it's time to come home. But then you're saying, go ahead, let it sink to the bottom. It's like this message is changing a few times. I mean, was that just, that's how it flew? Or are there nuances that I'm missing here?
I think it's part letting go of a lover or something, and then sort of letting go of, you know, as a metaphor, the water as a metaphor for letting the past go, in a way, for me, letting past. So for me, the song kind of came about, really erupted inside of me. Like I started crying, and it was just like this crazy, I couldn't write it. While I was writing, I was sobbing. You know, the studio people are like, you know, Bobby Charles haunts the studio. You know, it's haunted by books. Bobby Charles spent a lot of time there. He wrote a lot of famous Louisiana songs, you know, and so he spent a lot of time there. So it was like, oh, maybe Bobby Charles brought me this song, you know, I don't know. It's partly about me. It's partly about letting go of the past. And I always try to put hope, a hopeful spin on things. That's kind of like my thing, you know. It's like, it's really bad, but there's hope, you know, redemption is possible.
And when you put second person in there, when, you know, it's about time you drift home, it's talking to yourself, it's musing about, it's not.
Yeah, because in me, there's a sense of, I've been in the city, you know, and I, even in all my songs, like I'm going to move to the country when I'm old and all that, city life song. So it's like, well, maybe I've written my entire biography and song. Maybe I will go to the country at this point. Who knows? I love the city, though.
All right. I want to move on from this song soon, but I do have to ask. So about the overdubs, you have this really nice horn chords and things come in later. And he thought about the discussions that went on of what do we need to finish this song?
So speaking of counter melody, that was just a counter melody that came to me. And I knew it wanted to be very simple. And we overdubbed that here in New Orleans, the horns. I just sang it to him. Jason Mingledorf is amazing. I mean, he kind of like took my little singing part and made it and arranged it and told the Satoru. They kind of arranged a little horn section for that. But yeah, those are counter melodies that kind of came about.
And in terms of the backing vocals that you introduce on the chorus, that's, I assume that's just you doing it sort of at the time?
Yeah, I think that's me.
Yeah, any thoughts about it, sort of how big you decide to make that in any given time? Because it would be very easy with a big chorus like that to like, let me layer myself four times. Let me do, you know, but this one is, it's just, okay, we just have basically a harmonic above yourself to just thicken it a little bit.
Yeah, just a third harmony. I think the engineer, brilliant too. I think a lot of things came about and converged upon this little record because he really fans out. He did some things with mixing. And as far as that's concerned, I think Justin was probably like, yeah, that sounds great or whatever. You know, like, I can't remember. Let me think. Because it's been a year now. We did do some vocals here in New Orleans about maybe 4 months after the initial recording. So money. So like, you know, if I could just be in the studio all the time and be constantly recording and doing stuff, but because of time and money and, you know, we had the initial grant to get this ball rolling, so to speak, from Threadhead. The Threadhead Cultural Foundation is a wonderful organization here in New Orleans, and they fund musicians, local musicians here. And so that got us rolling. And then of course, you know, we have to finish it. Yeah, we did some overdubs, the horns here, and I did do some backups here in New Orleans as well with House of 1000 Hertz, which is a local studio. As far as vocals, I usually just, you know, kind of know what I want as far as the backups are concerned.
I mean, have you moved or messed around with doing home recording for any of this just to at least just like, hey, record the stuff in the studio. Let me take it home. I can spend as long as I want harmonizing and doing a little extra stuff, then get it back in or, you know, have people send stuff over the internet. I know this was a very common thing during the pandemic, especially of like, well, I'm not going to do everything in the studio, but I could assemble stuff.
No. You know, I can record a little demo on my GarageBand, but that's not me.
It's an investment of time and energy. And
I'm one of those people. I'm probably not going to have the home studio. And I just don't know enough about, I kind of miss that. I've always gone into studios. I have always relied on engineers. And since I think 99 is when I first went into the studio for my first record. And I love going to different studios. I usually recorded a different studio every record. So I kind of like to hop around. But I probably go back to Dockside because I really enjoyed their sound. And the engineer there is really great. And he got these great effects kind of that are, you don't know they're there until you're like, oh my God, there's that thing he did where he does with my vocals where he just sort of fans them mm-hmm. out kind of in this, it's kind of ethereal, but it's kind of washy, you know, but I don't know. It's pretty cool. But it wasn't until I got interested into production that I started hearing, because I would just go in and record whatever and it would be whatever. And I just, you know, but when I started getting into production, because I never really had a sound of my own. It kind of just formed over the years because I could do New Orleans-y songs, I could do country songs, pop songs, and kind of just always wrote in different genres. But I think it's sort of all coming together now, you know?
Well, let's get the second song out there as another example before, you know, so we can talk more about production. I had picked this one, 1111 from Rise of the Fall 2017, just a couple albums ago. It's over 5.5 minutes long. But there's not any more to the lyrics or anything. It's just, let's let this develop a little more. Let's do a little more overdub, some more changes in intensity, things that go up and down. A few words about this before we hear it.
Me and Renee produced this record, The Rise of the Fall. So that's all us, me and Renee in the little home studio, my friend Jacques Delatour. I mean, we recorded it initially at the shed and then the overdubs, all of the layers that you hear mm-hmm. were done at Jacques' house. And yeah, that song just came to me too when I was on the road. I was like, oh, we got this hole here. I was like, well, I'll play clarinet, you know? So I play clarinet on it, barely play since I played in high school, but I played for 20 minutes before my, you know, lips gave out. But yeah, we did a little bit of that and he's great at layering stuff. So we did like 8 vocals at the end. I think it's about 8 overdubs. Came out great.
Love you.
Any thought about that initial? That sounds like it could be the foundation to the whole song, but I'm guessing.
That was the drummer's idea. Chris Pilant played drums for me for 20 years before moving to Florida. So he's like, let me do this. How about this? Before the music comes in. I'm like, okay. I think Chris Adkins is on this record.
So that main. That sounds very like you must have sang it at somebody, or was that just what the guitarist decided to do in the first?
That's all Chris Adkins. Yeah. He does a really cool part that when I was listening to the Ruffs, I remember driving down the interstate and I had to call him and I had to tell him, oh my God, that. Da-na-na-na.
Okay. So he's echoing himself. So that's his own. Both of those are him.
Us, him. Yeah. And it just pulls it together.
This is really one where, because you leave those spaces of like, what is going to happen in this? Let me just play.
I won't open my arms, but I can't see past love regressions.
So just that you finish a line, and at least the first time you got the tss, And there's some variation. It's never that blatant, but you know, the same thing happens again and again after many lines. So are you going to go, don, 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 don? Is the whole band going to play it together? Is it just going to be you? It seems like there's enough song that you have to decide. Again, was this a three of you maybe playing it live to sort of work out the basic shape? Or was this really just layered piece by piece?
No, the song was being played live. Basic tracks were done, just like a regular. I think we did that at the Shed.
Nice drum mics. You gotta do that somewhere else.
So it was done in the big studio. It's closed down now, the Shed, sadly. But yes, it was basically just a live track with, you know, parts and the band just kind of. Chris is a real live drummer, so he's playing it like he would out at the clubs kind of thing. So it kind of has that feel. I think it's pretty much live except for the overdub vocals and everything. But yeah, as far as the hi-hat, I think that's just Chris.
And that you're just increasing tension at various points during this, which is hard if you're just playing your acoustic and there's probably a tight compressor on it when you're recording. You know, it's not like when you're live by yourself and you can go from zero to huge. You have to have the band's cooperation and you have to have as much a mixing act as a performance act to actually like make it.
That song is tough to play live. I actually haven't played it in a long time because it's not something I can play solo. But I can play it. What I end up doing is cutting out the end and just ending with it's 11-11 and I love you, you know. But yeah, the band really, you know, I love dynamics. Dynamics are the key. So the drop down and the pulling up and all that, that song lends itself to it.
As a point of contrast, I will link folks to your solo performance of the song Soundtrack, which is one of those that also has the dynamic movement and a lot of repetition, but it completely works in a solo setting because it is just much more relentless. That this is just so mellow to have this, you know, stretch that out. You'd really have to have a patient audience, whereas that song, you're just driving it into their skulls.
That's exactly. That's a good take on it.
Let me play a couple sections from here. I mentioned in the last one, your vocal choices, that how are you going to phrase things? What sort of pauses? For some reason, I put a note on the word smoke here.
With the clouds etched in smoke.
Okay, yeah, just that smoke, this thing that you're doing. Like, is that just kind of, that's what happened that take. And if you do it again, it's going to be different because you're just constantly experimenting. Or is this sort of, that's the note.
Yeah, pretty much phrasing is very important to me. So I'm not one to change the phrasing over the years kind of thing people do. Like it'll change a little bit, but for the most part, it's written as it's written. And I don't really vary from the phrasing. The phrasing is super important to me as a part. So it sits in its little pocket and that's where it's going to sit. Sure, I could drag it out, but I don't necessarily do that. It pretty much... That's the way I'll sing it every time, you know?
With the amount of times you repeat, it's 11-11 and I love you. You would think that there would be some variation. I wasn't listening specifically for that, but it's so integral to the rhythm. Like this is the melody. So you can't just decide and I love, you can't just do that randomly.
Right. That's a great observation. Yeah, everything's kind of sitting in its space and everybody lays down accordingly, you know, kind of those parts. Yeah, you really get into it. I love it.
Just think about this structure. So this chorus, I usually think of it as a refrain when it's not actually, we're building to the chorus, like in High Tide, that's a chorus. But if you just, the thing that is the beginning, you know, the thing that will go through people's heads, and then you have the verse, such as it is just, well, I have two more lines after that. I do the refrain and then do two more lines, and then I'm going to go back to it. How are you thinking about this in terms of verse one, verse two, whatever?
That one is weird because it's not like a normal thing that I do. I have little devices that I use, but yeah, it's kind of like a holdover after the verse. Yeah, it's kind of confusing for the band too, because it's so drawn out, but yeah, it's sort of like an explanation after the initial verse. I don't know what you would call that, but it's like the verse is super long. So the first half of it is different than the second half of it, I guess. But I would have to look at it in order to comment on it. The clouds etched in smoke, that part is like an addendum, you know, to the verse. That's not the form I generally write in.
And do you remember what this is about and what's holding those different addenda to the various iterations of 1111, how those actually all relate to each other? Is it just...
Well, I was just in a hotel room and, you know, I think it was 1111 and I just like strummed the note. And sometimes it's completely inspired, you know, in the moment. And I just was like, in A, I think it's A flat. It's 1111 and I love you. And then the verse, slow summer day. Yeah. I wanted to paint a picture. And I usually try to paint a picture that's not fully colored in so that you can color in whatever you like. It's kind of the way I write. At least I'm always trying to get there. I'm trying to get to an abstraction or a painting or a picture that you can see that's not fully developed maybe. Or maybe all of the pieces in the painting are not there or something.
Well, in this case, a lot of the imagery is about painting or colors or shadows or something visual. So you're mixing stuff like that with, you know, I want to open my arms, but I can't see past love regressions. Just spin away on a road stretched thin like your conscience. These little psychological things thrown in. I mean, if it was all just colors and shapes, I wouldn't like it as much.
Yeah, I think it's definitely relationship, trying to move past some blockage, you know, or something inside of you that holds you back or something. Yeah, a lot of my songs are breakup songs, but this one is about sort of a couple of people, I think. I think I was on the road with said person.
Well, let me play from 312 where I think the phased clarinet part comes in. So I guess this is actually getting us into what counts as the bridge. I mean, it's still the same chord progression that you had before, but at least you've changed the rhythm and we're going to have some movement. Yeah. Any thoughts about, given that it's almost like a mantra, this repetition, like how do you even have a bridge? Oh, well, let's introduce some different sounds and some slightly different rhythm.
And the phrasing is different. So it's sort of like, it's kind of R&B to me in a way. It's a different melody on top of that. Same form. I'm just trying to send hope, kind of in a way, but it's probably also about me.
More second person stuff aimed at yourself, because who else would you be singing, you spend all your time hurting? Like,
yeah, and your path is dark and uncertain. And some of those things people would say to me just in passing. And I like markers on your road. I don't, that came from a friend and she like said it. And then it's crazy how that happens. Sometimes that'll happen where it's like this conversation gets thrown in there too, you know?
Yeah, I guess that's the same, you know, what I was saying with the one's guitar rhythm can get repetitious. You write so many songs and so having something bounce back to you, lyrics even more so, that if you're just writing straight from your imagination. So I know a lot of writers, they will go and listen to other people's conversation. They'll do things purposefully to bring in, like, let me open the newspaper. Let me see what's there. That's kind of unnatural for me. I don't do a lot of that intentionally. I mean, maybe it seems like even if somebody else said it, it made its way into your lexicon.
Right. And that could be why. I think for me, it's just it's like a funnel from the sky, from God. You know, if it's inspired in that moment, then it is pure. And I try not to mess with that. If the initial inspiration is really good, usually I cry or something, but usually the initial inspiration will come and then I'll try to flesh it out kind of thing. And, you know, kind of like that, but it may take a few years for songs to finish. Sometimes I'll have a melody rolling around for 2 or 3 years and I'll keep coming back, even though I maybe didn't even write it down. Maybe it's just a recurring thing. And then the end will finally come, or some part that I needed will finally come. Cause I've got like 3 songs right now that are just, they're not letting me finish them for some reason. And I keep picking up the guitar and but generally speaking, the initial inspiration, I always feel like comes to me and it kind of just comes down from the sky. And that's only the only way I can describe it. And it comes through me. And sometimes I don't know what I'm going to say. And then I just catch that wave. If I can catch that and write it down, then that's the beginning of something that I can work on. But I don't necessarily sit down and go, I want to write a song about this. That's not the way I write. So,
yeah, well, so that's interesting. I mean, given how much you're relying on inspiration for those songs that do take multiple sessions to come to fruition, does that sometimes turn out as, well, you did a pass on some lyrics, but then you get into it and you're editing your own lyrics extensively, or having another burst of inspiration, like, oh, let me add this, what I thought was an unrelated idea, and put these together. Like, how much self-editing are you doing?
I do a lot of self-editing, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, I went through a phase where I was like, okay, I had self-edited myself to the point where the producer was like, this is a great song, we need to record this. And I'm like, I threw that song away, it was in my book. And it was Dancing in the Kitchen, which was the last record. And, you know, people love that song. And I'm just like, that was my throwaway song. But it's rhymes and it's cute. It has something, you know. But speaking of which, on Dancing in the Kitchen, there's a song called Back on My Feet, which the whole song was written for many years prior to that. And I never had the final line for the third verse. And it was just like, I wanted to say the bridge was going to blow. And I'm like, I can't say blow. And then I realized, I was like, oh, it's burn. And then that came years later, burn. Because you know I'm going to burn the bridge. You know, it's like, why did it never come to me? And it's like, what's the verse? Come to me, my darling. Let me fix what ails. I might fail. But I'm trying to bridge the sea between us. Everybody knows I'm gonna. And I never had the last word. I was trying to say blow. And I'm like, no, that's not. I'm like, burn. Everybody knows I'm gonna burn. Anyway, that whole song was finished without the one word. Same thing with I Waited Too Long on the new record.
So usually you just give up and have an instrument do so. I guess you can't do that with one word, but if there's just a line missing, just have a guitar riff. You know, just
the words have a phrasing that, you know, you have to have kind of to fit. For me, it's like little Legos that fit in the spot, right? But case in point, for the new record, there's a song that Renee Coman gets credit for, which is I Waited Too Long. I waited too long. And I had everything written and I'm in the studio rehearsing with them. This was for a live show. This was before we even went in the studio, probably 6 months prior or whatever. It was what he wrote. It's worth the wait. He wrote the very last part of the song because I had this song is forever. Bone, and I had nothing. And I'm like, he goes, it was worth the wait. And I was like, perfect.
There you go. 50-50 co-write for your one.
That's exactly right. But you know what? It wouldn't be that song because he sort of summed it up. I needed something to sum it up, you know?
Hi, I'm Chris Gethard, and I'm very excited to tell you about Beautiful Anonymous, a podcast where I talk to random people on the phone. I tweet out a phone number, thousands of people try to call. You talk to one of them, they stay anonymous. I can't hang up. That's all the rules. I never know what's going to happen. We get serious ones. I've talked with meth dealers on their way to prison. I've talked to people who survived mass shootings. Crazy funny ones. I talked to a guy with a goose laugh, somebody who dresses up as a pirate on the weekends. I never know what's going to happen. It's a great show. Subscribe today. Beautiful Anonymous.
Well, you've given a fine introduction to what will be our final song. But before we get to that, I need to make you regress to early career. You picked Drugstore from Crossing Frequencies 2001. So speaking of sort of cutesy This definitely sounds like you had an idea, I'm going to do a swing thing, but then the producer or, you know, the band, which in this case, there's a trombone.
Okay. I don't know if you know Dave Easley, very accomplished, amazing musician, pedal steel player in New Orleans. Well, he lives on the North Shore now, I think. He's a genius ear guy. He plays trombone on his lap steel or his pedal steel. So he puts an effect on there to make it sound like a trombone.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Not a trombone. All right. I was wondering why I wasn't hearing more of it if there was an actual trombone. All right. Well, say a few words about where you were at. So this is your actual first album. I'm a little confused in that the press release was saying, well, this is your 10th album, but I'm only counting like 8 plus a live thing. So is there an ancient pre-Crossing Frequencies album that you don't let people hear or what?
No, there's a Honey Pots record and there's a live in Italy record of songs that were already recorded elsewhere. So I'm kind of counting a record that I did with the Honey Pots, which is an all-female thing I did in 2012, which I have songs on there that I also have recorded, but there's a few songs on there that have never, ever been recorded elsewhere. So I'm counting the live Dal Vivo. It's called Dal Vivo. I lived and recorded in Italy in 2009 with Roberto Luzzi, who is in the Playing for Change band. So that I'm counting that. But yeah, the very first record I did was Crossing Frequencies.
Okay. So yeah, say a little about where you're at with this and how this arrangement got chosen. The narrative itself, I mean, is very vivid and it's very theatrical and kind of goofy.
It's one of the songs I remember working really, really, really hard on to get every lyric just to fit perfectly. And I was just obsessed with the song for a while writing it. I remember that. And I remember, you know, we'd go home and we were partying it up in New Orleans. I was young. I was like rock and roll, playing till 4 in the morning, going to the 24-hour K&B store, you know, on the corner down in Napoleon, uptown. And yeah, it was a throwback to the New Orleans style swing. And people still come up and request that song. I still play it because it's just fun. And people are not expecting the drug. They're not expecting it. I buy my groceries at the drugstore. They're not expecting the line, you know. So it's kind of fun to see people go, oh my God, hilarious, you know.
I paid for 39 for 6 slices of ham. Yeah, but I don't really care because I got money to spend. You know, I'm working all night. I make my money singing. And what I really need now is a drink is what I'm thinking. A little something to tide me over. I buy my groceries at the drugstore. Well, I'm walking down the aisles and I'm dazed and confused. I got some change in my pocket I can't wait to use. They're open 24 hours, so you've got plenty of time. I'll take a microwave pizza and a bottle of wine. If you like me, you've been there before. I buy my groceries at the drugstore. Well, I like Walgreens, yeah, but don't get me wrong. But you can buy a loaf of bread and a bottle of rum. Oh, don't criticize me for the way I like to shop. I don't want to walk around in circles just to save a buck. Yeah. The bright lights are shining, they got just what we need. A 40 for you and a 22 for me. Well, it ain't all that bad once you know the score. I buy my groceries at the drugstore.
Thank you. This is sort of sounds like in the Lyle Lovett world of...
Yes. Well, he's amazing.
Although maybe he's just drawing on the same genres that you're drawing on. It's not necessarily that that's his sound. You're saying it's the New Orleans swing sound.
Yeah. I think every record that I've ever done has a New Orleans-y mambo or swing on it and a rock and roll-y, stonesy thing on it or a straight up country song sometimes. Because I grew up on country music, but yeah, that's great. I'd love to be compared to Lyle Lovett.
Well, it has all those, like, let's do these little stops. And maybe you're just tapping on your guitar. Or the hi-hat is doing something to get us back in.
When I listen to my voice in that song, I cringe because I'm really, really, really trying to sell it. And I was so, it's just funny.
Is this just what you were doing for this? Or you just hadn't sort of found your voice overall yet?
I had not found my voice yet. No, I was just, you can tell how hard I'm trying.
I tend to just like go back to listen to the artists. Oldest stuff and go forward. And I definitely felt like by album 3 or 4, like it really kicked in. Like, okay, that's what you are. Before that, I wasn't really sure. Like, okay, she's a blues singer. I don't know. This is a genre.
Definitely very important to me to find it. Mm-hmm. I knew when I was starting out that if I didn't sound just like me and no one else, I just knew how important it was for everyone to, if they hear me, they know it's me. And I think that I accomplished that.
There are some things with the arrangement that remind me, though, it's not just the straight dictated by genre. Just that we're going to switch from swing to straight, and that's going to be like, oh, and now we're going to start pushing forward. I mean, this really sounds like something that maybe you were motivating on your acoustic of like you're directing the band and not just the producer is doing his thing or something.
Yeah. I think it switches to country. Yeah. It changes to like a double time, I think at the end.
And to a big like piano, Fats Domino, whatever.
Yeah.
Ding, ding, ding to bring you to the end of the song. Do you have any memories about sort of how was that all very much just like let the band do its thing and try it a few times? Or was there any more? Sounds like you said you were not in the position where you were asking for what you wanted yet, right?
Oh, no. That was recorded at Word of Mouth Studio. It was the very first time I was ever in the studio. Mm. It was the very, like, I didn't know anything of what I was doing. I had these songs.
Did you know those musicians? Or these are the studio musicians?
No, I was playing with, that record is half of the band that I had when I was playing downtown Margaritaville. And half of the record is players that I hooked up with a new band, and it's half of them. It's basically the band that became Bad Mayo, Lindjory and Bad Mayo. I did 2 records. Maybe those are the records you're missing. Lindjory and Bad Mayo did Blackberry Winter, my 2nd record. And then we did Spun as my 3rd record.
Okay, Blackberry Winter, I have not heard. Yeah, that was...
Okay, so, and sometimes it comes under a different artist. So they separate it out on iTunes
That's
or whatever.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Like, can you just put it all under Lindjory? No. So we followed up and I did 3 records in 3 years, basically, when I started. So the first one was I met the bass player of this other band, Bad Mayo, and then he ended up coming in and helping me produce and finish the first record, which took me 3 years because I knew it wasn't the way I wanted it to sound. And I kind of always knew what I wanted, but I didn't know how to, I had never worked in the studio and I didn't know and certain things and blah, blah, blah. And just basically a bunch of people showed up and it's like, oh, we have Chris Mule here to lay some lead guitar down, or we're going to change this song. And we actually did a bunch of shifting around on that first record because I didn't know what I was doing. And then I had help come in about a year and a half later. And then it took me like 3 years to come out with it because I started recording in 98, 99, 2000. The record came out 2001. So that record, that was the longest I've ever taken, I think, on a record because I was so green, you know. And then we changed studios. We went somewhere else. We recorded the drums somewhere else. I mean, it was really, that record was very much mishmash, kind of overdub, layering everybody at different times and sort of thing like that. The last song was done live, I believe, Waiting for You to Call. And but anyway, Kevin O'Day, he's, rest in peace, he's gone. Great drummer of New Orleans. He plays drums on a few tracks. And then I think Corey Walters, who I played with at the time, she's an amazing drummer in town. I think she plays drums on a few tracks. It's just 2 or 3 different bands just all thrown in.
So it sounds like even if you weren't the producer, as in the one in the studio directing, it's not like you won a contest and somebody said, come in and be in the studio. This is like you over time, in the jazz sense of who got everybody together and paid for the damn thing. You were the producer right from the start, it sounds like.
Well, I think my boyfriend at the time, Dave Stover, bassist, was my bassist. He came in and played bass. And can't remember if he plays bass on everything. I don't think so. But he came in and sort of with the clipboard, and he really loved, he knew how to schedule people in the studio, and he knew how to, like, okay, you know, don't have them come in and just sit around. Like, we're going to do this first, and then we're going to do this. And then he sort of had a knack for the production of it. So I kind of gave it to him to finish and help me finish. That's how it got finished, because I didn't think, I was a little too scared at that point to be in charge or something. I don't know. So anyway, he made it easy because he was sort of like, I could tell him like literally what I wanted, and then he could convey that or whatever and say, okay, we have this guy coming in to overdub this, and we have to get this, you know, we have this guy coming to do the guitar. And so it's kind of like that. And he was actually a good arranger too. We did some songs where I wrote the melodies and the lyrics, and he did the arranging, which is kind of where I learned how to arrange, you know, verses and bridges and choruses and all that. Because I was just going off inspiration, and I just do verses and choruses or whatever. And I kind of learned some tricks from him as far as like half chorus, phrasing, kind of little bit of, yeah, I do that trick a lot. And then I also do something else that another producer told me that I do in every song, which I don't even know that I do it, and I never even notice it. But I do a half step. I do a half step in almost everything.
What do you mean? I mean, you're not modulating the whole song up a half step. It's not that. What do you?
No. There's a half step in whatever key it's in. There's like Sugar on the Floor is D, A, B minor, G, but there's an F sharp in there I throw in. So it's like an odd thing that I throw in.
Sure.
Once I started looking at it, and I was like, oh, wow. He goes, you put a half step in almost everything. Like, I did Come to My House with John Porter. He's a British producer that was in, he was my neighbor for a few years, who's got like 13 Grammys. And yeah, he pointed that out to me. So
was that, you said you learned to do the arrangements from this whole first album experience, which was lasting years. When then you started playing with Bad Mayo, was that also like, oh, well, they have their own thing and they kind of do the arrangements? And, or were you already to the point of actually playing with a steady band like that and then getting beyond that? But it sounds like you weren't being Lynn Drury and the Somethings. Was there a political reason for that, or a financial reason, or what?
Well, I knew to keep my name throughout. I mean, that's pretty much business 101. I knew that I would be in the Bad Mayo band, but my name would be first. And that's just something that I knew to do. I wasn't going to be in the Bad Mayo band. I'm Lynn Drury. I'm bringing you all the vocals and I'm bringing you the songs. He didn't have any really songs. I mean, he had some songs, but we kind of split it 50-50. But at that point, we were, all of those guys can sing their butts off. So we became a band because we got together all the time and rehearsed. And that sort of, then when we recorded Blackberry Winter in Mike West's studio in the Lower Nine, that was a great experience. I mean, nobody could see each other. We're B3s in the kitchen with the door closed. And the drums were in the kitchen, I think. And so me and the bassist are in the, near the control room, like near the living room. So that was all just, we knew the song so well. We had rehearsed so much that we were ready to do a record in 2 days. So we recorded it live completely, except for me going back and doing vocals and stuff like that. Yeah, Blackberry Winter was done in 2 days. Spun was done at Piety Street Studios. Again, those songs were completely rehearsed and the band was tight. And we went in and did our thing, you know, over like 3 days, I think. And Lynn Drury and Bad Mayo was short-lived, but it was a fun time having all three-part harmonies when you sing and everything. I have some old tapes, 2-inch. We recorded Spun on 2-inch, and one day I'll get the 2-inch tapes out and maybe release some old songs that were never put on the record. You have these amazing harmonies.
All right, let's conclude. We're, again, going to wrap up the whole thing by playing I Waited Too Long, which you already mentioned. I guess before I let you go, so do you already have, you mentioned three songs that won't let you finish them. How far ahead? Like, do you have a whole other album's worth of stuff ready to go? Are you already making plans to record?
Yeah, I have enough to go in probably right now. And yeah, for sure. I got half a record ready, the way it's going these days, you know, you have to have a single coming out every month. So I'm going to probably be going back in and doing a day, just one day. I want to try this in my head. I mean, of course, the band, they don't, what? You know, I'm like, no, I want to go in and go start to finish mixing, overdubs, everything. Just one song, one day. You know, I've never done that. So I like to do things I've never done. So we'll see.
Well, pleasure talking to you. Pleasure getting into your catalog.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
I like this one. Anyway, here it is. I waited too long.
Oh, I think that's Roddy Romero singing back up.
Oh.
Yes. He's amazing. Lafayette musician.
Sing my own true song, worrying so about how it came out wrong. Only I saw straight out of the gate. I waited too long, I started too
Thanks so much to Lynn. Hear more of her at lynndrury.com. I have quite a backlog of interviews waiting to be released for you to hear. First is with Kim Ritchie, another great singer-songwriter, beautiful voice. Then I'm very honored to have just spoken to Richard Thompson, one of our finest living songwriters. And finally, I talked to Pat Mastellotto, a drummer who has played on many things, including he was in Mr. Mister, he was in King Crimson for a long time, he played on the Friends theme song, many other things. So come back for those. Make sure you're subscribed at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you support the effort at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, you will be enabling this project to continue, getting good karma. You'll get my episode notes with the lyrics and structures, and you'll get an entirely ad-free feed. I also want to ask you to go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/book and check out our new book by The Partially Examined Life. I'm a co-author. It has transcripts. It has essays. It is very awesome. partiallyexaminedlife.com/book. Hope you're doing well, enjoying the better weather, keeping creative, keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Litzermeyer signing off.
I love this covered trees. City streets laid out, they glitter like diamonds from some